This is because they live for the most part in their imagination. They are to each other a kind of vision of paradise. And in one sense, love is indeed a paradise. Of all human realities, it is the best vestige of mankind's ancient joy and the best foretaste of eternal joy, but like paradise, it must be duly merited and conquered. Its price is many blind gropings, trials, failures and new beginnings. Man's love is a wounded love as those who have lived it know well. The fever of the flesh, subject to heated passion and caprice, must be purified. The spiritual disease of egoism must also be purified, for the joy of love can quickly degenerate into a demand to be served. To keep the body in its role of servant and to open the soul to the gift of grace, Christ is there, the vigilant Samaritan who binds and heals. By the grace of marriage, something of Christ is passed on to us which appeases our flesh and makes it participate in the transparency of his glorified body, which dilates our heart and teaches it to open and give itself. Grace of Transfiguration. This interior grace of healing and purification is not the only one. Or rather, it is the germ of another grace of elevation and transfiguration. By the grace of Christ, love learns not only to conserve itself but to transcend itself. It transcends itself by total renouncement of itself and sacrifice to the other. All Christianity is mirrored in that period of time between Good Friday and the dawn of Easter morning, that is to say, in a mystery of death and resurrection. Die that we might resurrect, such is the law of Christian life, such is the law of Christian love. How entrancing and yet pathetic it would be to silhouette against the background of daily life the many deaths and resurrections in which love relives the mysteries of Christ. To renounce one's personal comfort that the other may be happier, is to die and resurrect, to renounce the other's satisfying presence that he might fulfill a necessary task elsewhere, is to die and resurrect. To accept the other's suffering as a condition of closer union with God, is to die and resurrect, to consent to be misunderstood, neglected, perhaps even forgotten, if this supplication merits the exceptional graces which the other needs, is to die and resurrect. Here it is not simply a question of mortifying our pride, it means even renouncing the most normal pleasure, the most legitimate and most necessary to the human heart, that of knowing and feeling that one is loved. It is to this point that Christ leads his disciples. We must not think for a moment that the grace of marriage is a grace of comfort and ease. God does not spare those he loves. But the couples who have gone through these crises, these dark nights, know that their love is more alive for it. We have only to compare those homes in which a sluggish kind of love reigns with those where love has known labors and crucifixions to see on which side the glory lies. Even if they are not rewarded here below, husbands and wives of this caliber know that beyond the pall of death, which liberates us from our earthly tenements, they will find a total and definitive love. Daily deaths and resurrections, final death and resurrection, it is always the same mystery. The mystery of Christ, therefore, is the mystery of Christ in the home. Grace of Fertility. A grace of purification and transfiguration, the sacramental grace of marriage is finally the grace of fertility. The word may appear banal. To want a child is the normal instinct of love. In what way does the grace of Christ transform it? We might answer that Christ invites couples to have as many children as possible. But this is not always true. There are homes which are involuntarily sterile, others constrained to limit the number of children. Even were this answer true, it would be inadequate. The call of Christ is something other than a premium on quantity. By the grace of fertility, the very meaning of the child takes on a new value. To give visible form to the one flesh of marriage, to see this love mature into a new life, to strengthen the vitality of our country and perpetuate the community and the species, all of these things which constitute the grandeur and the natural necessity of procreation remain true of Christian love. But love adds a new dimension, for love is nothing less than giving children to God. In exorbitant, extravagant manner of speaking, which nevertheless expresses well the Christian meaning of generation. It throws new light on the meaning of procreation, but it throws light above all on their education. Procreation implies the education of the child. It implies bringing up a child in whom there is not only an affinity of possibilities on the natural plane, but also that other divine affinity, the grace of baptism. Collaborators with God, company redemptors with Christ, parents have the duty not only of inculcating in their child the sense of God, but of modeling it little by little in the image of its divine brother by cultivating the graces of baptism. The grace of marriage gives them the heart of God and the hands of God to fashion from day to day a masterpiece, a child like unto his child. Our analysis of the essential graces of marriage, purification, transfiguration and fertility, permits us to draw this conclusion. The first act of conjugal sanctity consists in believing in these graces. In the Gospel, when our blessed Lord prepared to work a miracle, he demanded faith. Do you believe? Go, your faith has saved you. For those who pledge their troth in marriage and successful love is also a miracle, he does not ask less. Do you believe that I am at work in your love? Do you believe that in every instance I offer you the graces to transcend yourselves? And when a young man and woman say yes to each other, they say it in all truth to Christ. Marriage is an offering to Christ. These last remarks lead to a consideration of the sacrament of marriage, not from God's point of view, but from man's point of view. For if a sacrament is the initiative of Christ, it is simultaneously, on the part of him who receives it, a visible and external act of surrender to Christ. As signs of grace, the sacraments are equally signs of faith. And this second sacramental reality is not less rich in spirituality than the first. What is the nature of this faith in marriage? For the purposes of clarity, we can sketch an answer under a threefold division: cooperation, commitment and consecration. Cooperation. The graces of marriage remain sterile without the cooperation of husband and wife. The faith that Christ demands of us is not a simple effusion of the heart, nor a vague adhesion to principles, it is a will to act. Here we touch upon a subtle paradox of the divine plan, the appeal that is made to man's liberty, the respect that omnipotence shows creatures is the very sign of love. If God only wanted to be served, he need only command. But he wishes to be loved. We must choose him, prefer him, go to him because we have decided to do so. Man proposes and God disposes is true enough. But the order of love is slightly different. God proposes and man disposes. What is the nature of this cooperation in marriage without which the spiritual riches of the sacrament would remain buried and sterile? Must we look above and outside of married life for a superhuman perfection? Many homes seem to have made precisely this mistake, and we breathe in them a rarefied air, a kind of odor of sanctity which puts them and us ill at ease. True sanctity is not that tension of the spirit and of the nerves that kills spontaneity. The sanctity of love is love itself. By that we mean that to cooperate with the graces of marriage it suffices, and it is, after all, very little, to love one another ever better and ever more. Thus to strive after a greater intimacy of hearts is to cooperate, to develop the spiritual life of our partner, to bring up the children, to support our family by labor in the factory, office or in the home, all of this is to cooperate with the sacramental graces of marriage. It is good at this point to rid our minds of all false or superficial notions about sanctity. We must not complicate things needlessly. If we see sanctity as a direct and normal effect of marital love, instead of something almost inaccessible, we will get just as far just as quickly. We can say that the spiritual level of a home is measured simply by the intensity, the tenderness and the plenitude of intimacy. From the wedding day onwards, love and grace work as a team. Grace invites us to a deeper love and a deeper love disposes us for greater grace. Commitment. But this cooperation is not simply the response of each moment to the graces of each moment, It encompasses our whole life irrevocably. It is this global, unconditioned, totalitarian quality of human response that we call commitment. It enters into the very notion of sacrament, for in antiquity a sacrament meant an oath and designated especially the military oath, which bound the soldier to the state for life. This meaning is still implicit in many of our sacraments, in particular those which constitute us in a state of life: baptism, confirmation and holy orders. In these, it is not only our actions, but our lives, our very persons, which belong to Christ. In marriage, it is in this manner that conjugal life, we should say the conjugal being, unites us to Christ. It makes us belong to Him unconditionally. To understand the full meaning of this commitment, we should take inventory of our conjugal domain and tell ourselves, our bodies belong to Christ, our children belong to Christ, our home belongs to Christ, our possessions belong to Christ. Is this going too far? Much farther even than you think, because it is not only our voluntary actions, our meritorious actions, that bear the sign of Christ, it is our life, our being, even when we are sinners. One who is baptized or confirmed or ordained, even though he may formally desire the contrary, cannot efface that indelible mark, that character as the theologians call it, which has bound him to Christ. We remain forever his disciples, his witnesses, his ministers. The same can be said for married couples. Their commitment towards Christ is measured by their commitment towards each other. Nothing in their lives can escape this grace or this responsibility. They are bound to Christ as totally as they are bound to themselves. Their union bears an ineffaceable imprint. It must progressively resemble, becoming more and more perfect, the love that Christ bears them. If they stop halfway, if they settle for a love like the others, if they seek to divide their lives into what belongs to God and what belongs to them, they are betraying their marriage vows, and it will be impossible for them to realize anything other than a mutilated and infirm love. Such love ultimately ends in the failure to realize the sublimity of the vocation to which they were called. Consecration. In the highest dignity of this vocation, at the summit of this commitment, we reach the third level of conjugal sanctity. Consecration. It is actually not enough that the faith of husband and wife cooperate in a response to grace. It is not enough that they commit their lives and themselves unconditionally and without limit. All of this is in the service of mission, the highest that can be fulfilled by a human being, which is the cult of adoration. To render homage to the Father, in the sense of total dependence that this word had in the Middle Ages, and to offer him the love he has given us and which makes us live, this is the task of man. It is certainly not the task of a slave, but of a son, because there is as much love as submission, as much gratitude as humility. The grace to carry out this most sacred of functions is given to us by the efficacious power of the sacraments. Baptism confers upon us the right of a citizen in the Church and permits us to participate in the prayer and sacrifice of Christ. The Eucharist enables us to enter into this prayer and sacrifice, and this is the highest act of cult. Holy orders, still more, bring us into closer communion with the Holy of Holies and empowers us to speak to God in the name of humanity. By examining thus each sacrament, we see that they all contribute to our return to God, to an adoration of love and expiation. So too in marriage. It inaugurates a consecrated life. That is to say, not only a life that comes from and lives by God, but which returns to Him without cease, glowing with gratitude, praise and repentance. By this sacrament, marriage is not only sanctified, but consecrated, that is to say, rendered apt for divine cult, just as a consecrated vessel which can henceforward be used in liturgical functions. And in this connection God has His role to play. The choice, the sign, and the mark which He places upon the person is His privilege, but this does not diminish the role of man, a will, constantly renewed, to offer to their source the joys, sufferings and labors of love. The faith of those who ask God to unite them in marriage must go that far.